give me some clever trick. I mean, we just solved the equations. But something very special happens here that you can bring this guy to the other side and just combine into the Cauchy-Riemann equation.
It's not because of this holomorphic properties.
No, I mean, you could have done it even if you're not Riemann, you would have, and you're sufficiently clever, you'd say, oh, look, now I have an infinite number of solutions. Because I can make any vector field that's a function of x1 minus ix2. Yeah. More questions or comments about lectures or tutorials?
Yeah, yesterday you tried that with the scale of variance that the
scale invariance or conformal invariance? Or
scale of variance.
Okay.
And do you have any intuitive?
Any?
Intuitive picture for how to understand the trace of
Yes. Yes. Didn't you derive it though? I know I forgot exactly what the tutorial was, but sorry.
Yeah.
So it was in a specific model or a general statement?
In general, like TUV is zero, you can show that there's a rotation current that's conserved.
Okay. Okay. So yeah, no, there is a way. Okay, so there is a way of deriving this just with pure thought, more or less. Modulo an issue of that generically, if you have a conformal field theory and you compute if you have any symmetry, there's a continuous symmetry, there's a conserved current associated to it, right, by another theorem. The first statement is that there is no canonically defined current. You can always change the current by something that's automatically conserved, okay? So the statement about conformal invariance implying the trace of the energy momentum tensor vanishes means that there exists an improved tensor, so there's improvement transformation such that it makes the traces. So you're asking me why this statement is true?
Okay, it is more like how should we understand this?
I'll tell you what I think is an intuitive way to think about it. So let's start with Poincaré. So translations imply the existence of a conserved energy momentum tensor, okay? That's something that you know. Two, I'm gonna make some kind of executive statements and that hopefully are agreeable. Then Lorentz symmetry. Actually imply in our relativistic theory, implies that actually the energy momentum tensor is symmetric. Actually, this is an example of improvement. If you compute the canonical energy momentum tensor that Peskin and Schroeder will tell you to do, like for a stupid color field, it's not necessarily symmetric. So you can make it symmetric by adding improvement transformations. But this is the natural one because, as you know, the energy momentum tensor couples to the metric, and the metric is symmetric. So this is kind of the canonical one that you would want to work with. Okay, three. Now, what do I want to say here? Yeah, I want to explain why one simple way to think about why the trace of energy momentum tensor plays any role in this business, okay? So let's do that. So now imagine I do a conformal transformation. So you know that the energy momentum tensor couples to the metric, right? That's essentially the definition of the energy momentum tensor. In this one definition of the energy momentum tensor, you couple it to curved background. And it's the variation with respect to the energy moment of the variation with respect to the metric, right? Now imagine I do I do a diffeomorphism. Then you know that delta h mu no. Right? That's whatever the thing is called, yeah, transformation. This is what happens when you do diffeomorphism. So now what do I get here? But now I want to be concrete. I want to know what happens under conformal transformation. If this is a conformal transformation, this I can replace this by what? Actually, I just erased it, but. Yeah, so let's forget about factors of two. Essentially, I can replace it by eta mu no delta psi, right? What am I getting here now? I'm getting the trace of the energy momentum tensor times d zeta. Right? Good. Now let's look first at dilatations. Zeta for dilatations is linear in x, right? So what prop? Okay, and if the theory is to be modulo anomalies, if the theory is to be invariant under dilatation transformations, the variation has to vanish, right? That's what it means that you have a symmetry. The variation with respect to the transformation has to vanish. So what condition do I derive for dilatations given that this is the variation? Can someone tell me?
What condition do you derive first?
For the energy momentum tensor. That's too strong.
So it should integrate to zero.
Yeah, so what's the right statement?
It's a
total derivative. So for dilatation, this implies that t mu mu is d mu of L mu. L mu is a priori an operator. And actually, I recommend that you do some. I think at some point there are exercises that, for example, you take a scalar field, lambda phi to the 4 in 4 dimensions, and you compute the canonical energy momentum tensor. The theory is scale invariant, but you're not going to get t mu mu to be 0. Mm-hmm. But you can prove that it's a derivative of an operator in the theory. And now let's look at special conformal. Now zeta goes like x squared, right? So what condition do I get? A priori, a stronger condition on the trace of the energy momentum. So what condition do I get? It's always looking at the same equation. It's a second derivative, right? If it's a second derivative, I can integrate by parts and kill delta psi. So this will be a term linear in x, right, now? But if t is a second derivative, I can always kill it up to a boundary term. So the statement that the theory is invariant under special conformal transformations is a statement that I can write it as a second derivative of an operator. Okay? So that's the most general statement about the conditions that a theory should have. The energy momentum tensor should obey for a theory to have dilatation and special conformal symmetry. And now the last statement, which I think actually is in one of the tutorials, but let me just say that now the claim is that you can improve, and you should always try to improve yourself. So improve team, such that so that I define a new team mu, which is team mu plus some om mu that is automatically conserved and so on and so on, such that t hat mu mu. So even though this guy is d mu L mu nu, I can always make the improved energy momentum tensor traceless. Is this clear or very? So let's think for a second. Say, imagine, let's go back to the energy momentum tensor. Can you think of and let's try to think of the energy momentum tensor derived by coupling to a curved background, to a background metric, right? So can you think of a term that you can write down in the Lagrangian that would give rise to a non-trivial contribution to the energy momentum tensor? Because it has a first non-trivial variation with respect to the metric, and then when I evaluate that in flat space, that variation is non-zero, and that it disappears when I go to flat space. Do you know of an object in general relativity that has this property? Actually, the Riemann tensor. In general, is the Riemann tensor. So you could try to modify. Actually, this will be a long detour, but actually, you can always think of improvement transformations as arising from coupling your system to a background field that couples to the current that you're describing, either a gauge field or, in this case, it's a metric, right? And writing the most general term that has the properties that I said, that it survives the first variations, okay? For example, I could have also added Riemann square, but if I do the first variation of Riemann square and evaluate the flat space, what are you going to get? Zero, right? Because you're going to get Riemann times the variation of Riemann. The variation of Riemann is non-trivial, but Riemann in flat space is zero. Okay. So you can think of the improvement transformations as saying you have your system, your Lagrange, you have your theory. Let's see if this notation makes sense. I don't want to introduce crazy notation. So, and now I couple it to a background metric minimally. You know, just whatever you see the Minkowski metric, you put the curve metric. That's the minimal way you couple to a background to a background metric. But now I introduce something. I can a priori introduce something like this. If I have an operator with the right properties, with the right symmetry properties, okay. And in this new theory, so this would give rise to an energy momentum T mu, say. This guy, when I do the variation, will define the energy momentum T mu hat. Okay. So the statement is that in a conformal field theory, you can go to a canonical frame where T mu hat is traceless. But you see that roughly speaking, the trace condition, at least it's very clear where the trace condition comes from, right? It just comes from the fact that the metric varies this way, and if you have a conformal Killing vector, you get a metric and you get the trace. Oh, so now that we said that, can someone guess? So imagine I give you a theory that conformal symmetry is broken, explicitly broken, like I give a mass to a scalar field. Can someone guess what T mu mu will be? So imagine I give you just something simple. So this theory breaks conformal invariants. Can you guess what T mu mu will be? What's breaking the conformal invariants? The mass term. So actually, what you're going to get is precisely 1/2 m squared mu squared. So actually, T mu mu essentially is what diagnoses if, yeah, something T mu mu in a suitable frame being different from zero is what diagnoses that you've broken conformal invariants. So imagine you didn't know anything, that this is a measurable parameter and so on. You would discover it by just computing this. And for example, in a theory that's classically conformal invariant, like Young-Mills theory, you can also diagnose, for example, the fact that the couplings run quantum mechanically, right? You have a beta function. Actually, there what you find is that T mu mu is a beta function of Young-Mills theory, F mu squared. So again, the trace of the energy momentum tensor diagnoses that is that the theory quantum mechanics is not conformal invariant because it's proportional to the beta functions. So this is a very, the energy momentum tensor is a fundamental object in physics, but in particular in conformal field theories. The energy momentum tensor, you should think of it as, is the operator that implements all space-time transformations, which is not surprising because it couples to the metric. So any space-time transformation that you ever thought of, that you ever heard of, can always the current can always be written in terms of the energy momentum tensor. Even though that's not probably how you learned it in school, whatever side, but that's the way to think about it.
I also remember that you mentioned something like if the system is kept, then the energy momentum tensor is not
defined. I'm sure you didn't say that. No, I said that there is no local operator. So in particular, there's no energy momentum tensor, there is no energy, therefore there is the coupling to the metric is trivial. So there is no dependence on the coupling of the metric, that's why it's topological. Okay, if there are no more, we should move. Okay, but maybe I should say something about, so last time we essentially studied, we did just kinematic, essentially, and we studied what the conformal algebra is and what the conformal group is. So first we saw that the transformations that are conformal, the infinitesimal transformations that are conformal are parameterized by a Killing vector, conformal Killing vector. Let me just write it one last time. And good, and then we identify what the generators were. good. What else did we say? Yeah, then we saw that there is an inversion transformation, which is a Z2 transformation that is not connected to the identity. And essentially from combining these two things, what we saw is like the conformal group. So the Lie algebra, okay, so the Lie algebra was the Lie algebra of transformation. So the Lie algebra is always the statement about the transformations that are connected to the identity was SO2, D. But actually what we found is that the conformal group is the, oh, yeah. So when you're doing LaTeX, for Lie algebra, there's a fancy frac command that distinguishes SO from, so I don't know how to frac in the blackboard, so. But one is a group, one is a Lie algebra. And what we saw is that this guy, just like the Punk, like the Lorentz group, has four components. And the conformal field theories are any conformal field theory by definition is invariant of the connected component. And then in the other components, you have inversion, which is conjugate to parity, and time reversal, just like similar to Lorentz. Okay? Good. Good. So what I said last time also is that, so whenever you have a symmetry, first you study the geometry of it and the group theoretical structure of it. But now we're interested in physics, so we want to implement those symmetries on a physical system. Okay. So mathematician is something that would be able to do this. The second step, okay, they should also be able to do this, but that's where we're going to start talking about how we realize symmetries on a physical system. So the basic object that we want to discuss are operators. In a conformal field theory, by definition, just like operators in a relativistic quantum field theory, any operator in a relativistic quantum field theory is in a representation of the Lorentz group, right? So it either has spin zero, half, whatever, okay? So likewise, we have to understand what is the analog of that here. What is the analog of saying that, what are the labels of operators in a conformal field theory that fully specify what the quantum numbers of the operator are? So for just a usual relativistic theory with no enhanced symmetry is the Lorentz spin. Now I want to see what other quantum number do we have to assign to an operator to fully specify its representation under the conformal group, okay? So just like what I said, so operators are in representation of the conformal algebra. Okay. So now the first thing we understand is what are the labels? So we know that the conformal algebra in particular includes the Lorentz symmetry, right? So we know that at the very least the labels will have to include the Lorentz spin. So we'll have to say whether it's in a spin zero, half, I mean, yeah, whatever. You have to tell me the Lorentz spin of your operator, right? Just like in the usual case. But actually that's not enough. To fully specify a representation in a conformal algebra, we have to do something more. And there are several ways to think about it. One of them is a more formal point of formal aspect. So the conformal algebra is SO2, D. If you know something about the representation theory of it is a non-compact Lie group because there are Cookie time dimensions. It's a non-compact because you have two time-like directions. In order to specify a representation of SO2, D, you have to specify the quantum numbers. That's not how mathematicians would say it, but under the maximal compact subgroup, which generated by M mu nu and the dilatation. So and then I'll go back and I'll give you a more physical explanation of why these are the right labels. So now the Lorentz spin essentially is, what you do is you diagonalize the Lorentz generator, right? So you say, you, That's what in linear representation is, you diagonalize it, and then you have some matrices that tell you what representation you are. So here, what we're doing is diagonalize the dilatation operator, and the quantum number associated to scale dimension, we usually call it delta. So here, okay, we have M mu nu, and if you wish, we associate spin. Here we have the dilatation operator, and we associate the scale dimension, okay? One nice way to think about this, why this is true, is the following. If you look at the finite transformations that you get from that, okay, so let's think physically. So if I have an operator at any point in Minkowski space, I can bring it to the origin by a translation, right? So the properties of the operator, the transformation properties of the operator under the space-time symmetry are fully determined by those transformations that leave the operator fixed at the origin, okay? So they're kind of eigen vectors of that symmetry transformation. And then the asymmetry algebra will tell me how to how the operator transforms anywhere else, because I can just conjugate by translations. So if I know how the operator transforms here, I can just trivially get how the operator transforms in the other room by conjugating by translations. And since I know how P commutes with everyone, I know everything in principle. So of all those symmetry transformations there, the ones that preserve the origin are precisely these ones. So M mu nu and V preserve the origin. Is that clear? D is very obvious, right? That preserves the origin. It extends x to lambda x. And did I say something? Yes, no, that's right. Yes. Sorry, yes.
Mu nu generates the Lorentz group. So I don't see how mu nu and D form a maximal compact group. Lorentz group is not compact.
Yeah, so here I'm being a bit careless about being in Lorentzian versus Euclidean signature. I for a second went to Euclidean signature. But no, because everything can be said properly, but then we have to complicate things arbitrarily without gaining much information. That's why I'm also giving you this argument. This argument doesn't care about the signature. But yes, formally speaking, there I went to Euclid signature. Good. So this explains why it is sufficient to specify the transformations of the operator under M nu and D, because then everything else is fixed by just translational invariance. Okay. And the big heroes in conformal field, well, one of the big heroes in conformal field theory is actually to determine this. These are related to, in different languages, to the critical, for example, remember we said that this describes the critical phenomena? These are related to the critical exponents describing, say, a phase transition. Okay? Okay, so now we have to say a little bit about how these numbers appear. What's their definition? I think for Lorentz, I don't have to write it down. You know what it means for an operator to transform under some specific representation of the Lorentz group. But now let's think about an operator O that has dimension, scaling dimension. What does this mean in letters? In letters means that D is an operator that acts on O and gives you it diagonalizes D and has eigenvalue delta. Yes?
Just a quick question. The scaling dimensions, they contain the same information as the critical exponents, but they're not the same? Or are they?
Well, it's the same set. I mean, mm-hmm. One critical exponent that tells you how the magnetization blows up, essentially, up to shifts by dimension and things like that, will be the critical exponent of the operator that describes the magnetization operator. So yes, it's exactly the same data.
So there's a simple formula to
Yes. And but as we will see, there is more to life in a conformal field theory than just the scaling dimensions. The three-prime functions are also important. And yeah, in critical phenomena, as far as I know, these are not studied so much because they usually just study the divergence of magnetization or magnetic susceptibility, heat capacity. But in CFTs, what we'll see is that I'm jumping ahead, but in a CFT, in some abstract nonsense point of view, the entire date of the theory is controlled by these deltas and the three-prime functions. Everything else is algebraically determined, conceptually at least. And one thing that we will see at some point is that this delta is controlled, is determined, is measured, if you wish, by the two-point function. So if I have an operator O with dimension delta, if I look at the two-point function of this operator, I can determine delta by looking how the power law behavior of the two-point function. So this exponent here tells you precisely the scaling dimension of the operator. So if you're able to put the system in the lattice or whatever and tune to critical point and you study these things numerically, you will read off the critical exponents by fitting to this. Okay? Good. Okay, so, oh no, but I think I, yeah. Okay, one thing that I think I forgot to say. So, we have to construct, operators have to fit in a representation of the conformal algebra, okay? And operators essentially split. Into two types, primary operators that this transform simply under a conformal group, and then we have descendants. This is not that different if you think of SU2, like a SU2 spin, right? So there are states or operators that are annihilated by some raising or lowering operator, okay? But then you can construct all the states in that representation by acting with the lowering operator, right? So these are like the primaries are like the highest weight states, and these are the ones that you get from the highest weight states by acting with a raising operator, okay? And the thing that's very nice is that these guys transform extremely simply under conformal transformations, but the descendants, the transformation of the descendants associated to a primary, so things come in families. So the families are labeled by a primary, and then you have descendants. And actually, the number of descendants in a given conformal family is infinite. Because essentially, if you have, okay, I should define what a primary operator is, okay? So a primary operator essentially is an operator that is annihilated by the special conformal transformations. Remember that, if you remember the definition, okay, so up to factors of I, let's try to focus on the physics of these things. So with respect to D, D is a lowering operator, right, remember? But remember that which operator had the opposite sign was P, right? Sorry, P mu. So this is very similar to the SU2 angular momentum, where you have J3, J plus, and J minus. It's exactly the same thing. So a primary operator, so K, if you act on K an operator, it wants to lower its dimension by one, right? Just like if you act with J minus, you go from M to M minus one. Do you know what so if you want to construct the ground state, so to speak, what is the low energy state, you're gonna look at the state that is annihilated by this, because you cannot go any lower than that. And that defines the primary. And then you construct the descendants by acting with P. So P, if I give you O, P acting on O will have energy delta, sorry, not energy, dimension delta plus one. Okay. But notice something. I mean, what is P? What, okay, so we know that this defines a primary. And actually, this guy defines descendants. So, but now I can act with an arbitrary number of P mu's. These are the descendants. So the primary is the one up here. So there is a conformal family, let's say. I'm trying to make an analogy with SU2. Hopefully that's clear. One important difference, of course, is that in SU2, the representations are finite dimensional, right? You start up from the top guy, but you end up at when M is minus J. This is a non-compact group, a compact non-compactly algebra, so this never ends. So conformal families are infinite dimensional. But notice that the heroes of the stories are always the primary, because these guys are just surrogates. Essentially, if you want to know anything about the descendant, it's totally trivially determined in terms of the prime, totally trivial conceptually. Because what is P mu of O in down-to-earth terms? It's just the derivative of the operator. So if you know the properties of, if you know the correlation functions of O, you clearly know the correlation functions of derivatives of O, even if you take 75 derivatives of them. Okay? Conceptually, it's completely determined. So the strategy here is to understand completely the primaries, and then the descendants conceptually are determined, and we'll have clever tricks to incorporate the effects of the descendants when we compute things. Okay. So is it clear that why K lowers the energy, not the energy, the dilatation operator, the dimension, and P increases it? So hopefully that's clear. Now what do we want to do? Yeah, now I want to, I guess, yeah, that comes a slightly nasty part, but that's just life. So now essentially what I want to do is to write down how a primary operator transforms under the most general conformal transformation. So in relativistic quantum field theory, you have done that for Lorentz transformations, right? If you have a field, an operator that has a spin 7/2, you know how it transforms under Lorentz transformations. And we want to do the analog of that for an arbitrary operator O that has spin S and dimension delta. Yes?
Oh, I was just wondering if there's some concept of whether the operator lives in the adjoint ref or fundamental ref. Because here, like, we're saying the operator has to live in the adjoint ref, right?
No, that's not the.
I don't know if. Like,
no, I think that. No, this is the usual. No, this is not the adjoint. This is just the usual statement in quantum mechanics that symmetry transformations, infinitesimal symmetry transformations, are implemented by the commutator of the symmetry generator with the operator. That's all.
It's not. I thought if it's a fundamental ref, the action of the group acts on it by just like a matrix on a vector.
This is an infinitesimal transformation. I think what you have in mind is something more sophisticated. Let's go back. I think what I'm going to do now will answer your question. But this is just true. This is just a general statement about. So I could do the same thing with the Lorentz group, right? I could do the same thing with the Lorentz group. I could say M mu nu O. And here I would get some horrible matrices, omega nu O, right? This will label the representation of O under the Lorentz group. You wouldn't call this the adjoint representation or something, right? This is just a statement that if you have a, let me not say more than that. It's just that one way to think about how you act on an operator is that you have e to the I, say e to the I delta, operator e to the minus I delta, you conjugate by it. Do the infinitesimal one, what do you get? You get a commutator.
One thing about that. So normally, when one saw a creation or annihilation operators, in that case, the spectral is associated to states instead of operators. While here, and I know there's some sort of correspondence between operators and states at some point in 50, but
yes.
Something can be said here about, here the categorization we're doing, the labeling we're doing, is associated to the operators. We're classifying all of the operator content of a theory in a way. That's what we're trying to do with these representation theory, right?
Well, we're Yeah, so we're just asking the question of how do you implement conformal transformations on operators such that if I concatenate transformations on the operator, it realizes the conformal algebra.
Yeah. So
this doesn't tell you at all, really. This will not tell us whether what the operator spectrum of a given CFT is. We'll have to do something else for that. This just we're doing kinematics. What the actual spectrum is a dynamical problem, and this will come later.
Spectrum would mean the energy, and that.
No, the spectrum means the list of primaries.
The list of primaries.
Yeah, we have to tell you how many primaries you have. Actually, above two dimensions, you can prove that the number of primaries is always infinite. In two dimensions, it can be finite. But I have to provide for you the list of all the primaries with all the corresponding deltas. And it turns out in a CFT, you also have to provide the three-point functions, and then you know everything. But this is dynamics, not kinematics. We're doing kinematics. Yes?
Just a quick question.
Yes.
I'm not sure, but I misheard that there is some operator that always has scale in dimension zero.
Did I say that? No, I didn't say it, but it's true. It's called the identity operator.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And actually, you can prove that in a unitary theory, so one that the norms in the Hilbert space have a positive semi-definite, the only operator of dimension zero is the identity. You can have theories that are not unitary that have operators that have actually even negative dimensions. And, yeah.
Oh, so, that's one question. The boundedness from below of D is related to unitary then? Because I mean...
No, that's not related to that. I mean, the unitarity is on top of this.
Okay.
Then you can see that delta is positive. Unitarity says that essentially delta is positive.
Okay. And boundedness from below is given by, it's just an extra assumption?
No, it's not an assumption. It's a statement about, you still have to have a representation.
Okay.
All representations have a lowest weight state. Now, the lowest weight state could have dimension, positive or negative dimension. That depends on the problem. I clearly didn't say that delta had to be positive or negative, right? I just said that, yeah. Okay, so.
Can I ask you?
Yes.
Why did we choose P to create this family? Are there other families created by the other, like the special conformal transformations or?
Well, so the special conformal transformations are the ones that I use to define what the primary operator is, right? The K is the one that I said that the operator is a primary.
But then can we use like translations or can we use Lorentz rotations to create a different kind of family?
No. So,
it's just P.
So, I mean, the point is that any operator in this family has a well-defined transformation under Lorentz transformations. This actually goes back to this, that all that I really have to specify, I'm not 100% sure what you're asking, but.
First of all, if I
act with mu nu, So I think the better way to say it is that any operator, I had a list, okay, here, any operator in this list here just maps the operator in a one given tower to itself. So because a given operator here in the tower has a well-defined spin. So mu nu doesn't move you in the tower.
Right. So
it just measures the spin.
Yeah, maybe the question is answered by the fact that M and D preserve the origin so they're not going to shift.
Yes,
to
yes,
the
yes,
same way
yes,
as
yes, yes, exactly. And also P has the important property that raises the delta, while M has doesn't, right? M commutes with D. Yes.
And just for more intuition for the actual numbers for this given dimension, let's say, are they integers or?
No.
Because the
simple
exponents are often right, like irrational.
No. They don't have to be.
So,
they can be anything. Okay. Now, in two dimensions, there are something called minimal models or rational conformal field theories, which actually the dimensions have to be are rational, but that's not the generic statement. For example, if you look at the critical exponents of the 3D Ising model, there is no sense in which they're rational.
Yeah.
But we don't care whether they're rational or not. Mm-hmm. Actually, at this level, we don't know whether, and we will see how to learn about how to kind of get an idea what are the possible values of delta. Right? We just said there's this delta, but what are even admissible values of delta? Okay. And actually, we get constraints from dynamics. We will say that, for example, I already said that if the theory is unitary, delta cannot be negative. But we will say that if we improve coalescing symmetry, which is something that we will discuss, then there are certain values of delta in a gap, in a certain range. If you know something about your theories, you could rule out possible values of delta. So essentially, CFTs are quite special things. So actually, the allowed values of deltas are very, very special. If you pick a random set of deltas, this will not be a consistent CFT. Now, you're going to see this from what I said before, but we will see it later. Right now, I'm just doing kinematics, so delta could be anything. Okay. But in the real world, the delta is not anything, and it's definitely not a rational number.
But do we still go up, like, plus 1, minus 1?
Yes. Yeah. No, that yes. No, so, yeah. So the lowest weight state can be anything, but of course, the difference between the lowest energy, the primary and the descendant is just separated by integers, because the dimension of P is 1 by dimensional analysis. Yeah. Did I see another hand? No. Okay, now it becomes slightly... Shit, it was so slow. Okay, so I want to see how primary operators transform under conformal transformations. So I'll do it in a way that will be very similar to what you have, I'm sure, seen for the Lorentz group. So what are we doing? So we're doing a transformation X mu, a conformal transformation X mu to X tilde mu, and I'm going to use this notation G acting on X. So G is a group element of the conformal group, okay? And G, if you wish, if you want to think of an infinitesimal transformation, is a function of all those parameters of A, omega, lambda, and B, right? You pick an element there, okay? And now we know, I'm not going to write all the indices, that what was a conformal transformation is something that obeyed. If you really want me to put the indices, I can do it, but I'd rather not, just for time. This is the equation that we've written many times now. And one thing that was very important that I said is that this equation could be written as R transpose eta R equals eta, so a local Lorentz rotation, right? If I defined R to be dx tilde dx e to the minus sigma, okay? So it wouldn't surprise you a lot if I have now, so now I said that the operator has two labels. One is a label A, I have to introduce some labels. A and delta. So A will represent the Lorentz spin. So it could be a vector index, it could be a spinner index, it could be a twice antisymmetric, whatever. And D is the scaling dimension that diagonalizes the dilatation operator. So now, under this transformation, I have to write something such that if I concatenate two transformations with group elements G1 and G2, I will get a conformal transformation of G1 times G2, okay? So let me try to motivate the answer. This is completely fixed. There is no arbitrariness here, so. Okay, so the first thing that we will do is, since we can think of R as a local Lorentz rotation, I'll do the same thing as you would do if you know the spin in user relativistic field theory, and just write the transformation under according to the spin of the operator, right? So here you will write a matrix LAB, but now instead of being the usual Lorentz transformation, I will use this matrix R, right? Because it plays the role of a Lorentz transformation, except that now it's a local. So that's why I write here R of X, okay? So this part is literally the same thing that you would do if I was only talking about the Lorentz transformations. You rotate, so you have two kinds of quantum numbers here. You have the orbital quantum numbers that have to do with the spin, okay? And then you have to also rotate the point in space-time, okay? So you have kind of spin quantum numbers, spin transformation, and if you I call it this orbital transformation because it acts in space-time. Now you could ask me, why do I have G inverse here? But this is something you should have thought about in your previous course, but the reason that you have this here is that you want the two consecutive transformations represent the conformal algebra. And you see that in order for the spin the action on the spin degrees of freedom and the orbital transformation to marry together, it's important they transform oppositely, okay? Good. But we're not done. Because we have another quantum number that we have to discuss, which is the scaling dimension. And now the scaling dimension, it has to be something that does not introduce any more indices, right? Because it's a scalar. And you know, in general relativity, you've studied objects. So by the way, this is the kind of thing that you would have also studied in general relativity, right? So if you do a diffeomorphism and the operator has a spin, you will get things like this. But what other degree of freedom do you have that will, what other quantity do you have that's canonical, that's a scalar, that's the density, or this. So the information about the dilatation operator is encoded in the density weight of your tensor. So if you remember in general relativity, tensors can be densities, which means that you can have a non-trivial Jacobian of the transformation here. So a primary operator is one that has a non-trivial Jacobian control with to the power delta, delta over D, to define what delta actually means. In case this was not clear, this L, do people know what these Ls are? So these are is a group homomorphism, which means that it's a matrix that satisfies the property that LG1 times LG2 equals LG1 G2. So it's a representation. Of Lorentz. Yes.
Can you elaborate on this bit on why there's a non-trivial Jacobian union?
Well.
How we know it transforms by.
Well. So the actual answer why this guy is there will be that that's the only way in which the conform algebra will be realized. But essentially, think of the square root of the determinant. I'm not sure what kind of intuitive answer you want, but I'm saying that the only thing that is Lorentz covariant that you can enrich the Lorentz transformations with, and that knows about under scalings, under dilatations, x goes to lambda x. But if you have an operator that has a non-trivial dimension, you expect the operator also to rescale with some weight that depends on delta. That's the only thing that you can really add. And this is just normalization so that so the delta transforms, when you look at the dilatation, delta transforms with a weight lambda to the delta. But they say that this factor is a factor that you've seen in general relativity. I mean, there are not many things you can write down that are Lorentz covariant. The only other new object you can introduce is this one. And but you see that if delta is non-trivial, it will give you an extra factor, some lambda to some power, which is what you expect. Yes?
I suppose also your hands kind of forced by that relation.
Sorry?
The fact that the dilation operator on O gives delta.
Yes. I mean, yes, all six by that, yes. But
we can always express in Jacobian the determinant of the matrix.
Yeah, this is what I mean. This is the determinant of this matrix. Yeah. This is what I mean by this kind of very compact notation. This is the determinant of delta x mu delta x tilde rho. Yeah. Okay, so now I'm going to give you the example. Maybe this helps a little bit.
When we say trivial delta, we mean like the normal dimension that a free field of that.
No. I mean, it depends what you mean. In free field theory, there is a conflict of a scaling dimension and mass dimension. They happen to coincide. In general, it's not the same. So no, by this I mean the eigenvalue of the dilatation operator. Yeah, so now let's look at under, let's take a scalar field. Let's take O to be a scalar. And let's look at dilatation. then this operator transforms as lambda to the minus delta or lambda inverse of x. So you see that the information about the scaling dimension of the operator is measured by how much the operator is rescaled when I do a dilatation. Okay, so now something that you can do. I'll write it quickly and then maybe I'll quit. But for many applications, actually, what you care about is about the this is a finite transformation. Actually, this is true for any conformal transformation. It doesn't have to be connected to the identity. This is also true for the inversion. But it's useful when you derive word identities to look at infinitesimal transformations. So I do x tilde is x plus zeta, as we've done before. And then I can define what the infinitesimal variation of operator O is. And what this is by definition, is OA. I mean, this is also something you've seen in your field theory course, I'm sure. That's how you define infinitesimal transformations acting on operators or fields. Okay. And if you work it out, let me see. So you get minus zeta mu d mu OA of x. So this is the orbital part of the transformation. So this is a statement that the operator is transformed, is moved. Then you have a Lorentz spin part. Okay, so zeta, you know what it is already. Zeta is the conformal Killing vector, right? The generic conformal Killing vector. This object is a Lorentz rotation omega mu nu, together with an induced but space-time dependent Lorentz transformation that you get if you do a special conformal transformation. By the way, I'm just deriving this by doing Taylor series of this. I'm not doing anything fancy at all. I'm just doing Taylor series of this to derive the infinitesimal form of the transformation. And this M mu nu R is the matrices that represent the Lorentz representation in representation R. Okay, so we have the spin part. So, and this has to do with the spin. Okay. Sorry, it doesn't fit in one line. And then I have a dilatation. Sorry. Dimension. Where this omega x, again, is also a dilatation plus a local dilatation that is induced if you do a local special conformal transformation. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So this is, and you see that compared to things that you've seen before, essentially you get, and this goes back to the intuition that I said many times before, that you can think of a special conformal transformation as a local Lorentz transformation plus a local dilatation. You will see very concretely in what sense this is true. Okay? Notice that B is weird. It induces, with you do a special conformal transformation, it does weird stuff. But actually, geometrically, what it really is just kind of a local Lorentz and local dilatation. And as I said, this also has this interpretation as the analog of P mu near infinity. Good, so now one way you can check that this is correct is that if I do two consecutive transformations, delta zeta 1 of O, delta zeta 2 of O, I get delta of zeta 1, zeta 2 of O. That's the statement that the conformal algebra is realized on the operators, okay? Where all these zetas, zeta I, is a conformal Killing vector. Good. I'm essentially out of time. Okay, so maybe you just, may I just say a few things, and you can think about them. It's better if you figure them out than if I tell you. So, good. So this essentially completes kind of a step two of kinematics. So first, in the last lecture, we derived the geometry and the group structure. In this lecture, we have built the way in which the conformal symmetry is realized on operators, local operators. Okay. Now, what do we care about? What we want to compute, what we want is to constrain. What are the physical observables in a conformal field theory, or in general in field theories? One of the main observables is the study of correlation function. In particular, correlation functions. And now, so this is a problem that whenever you have a symmetry acting on your system, have you heard of the word identities? So word identity is essentially the constraint that you get on your correlation functions by saying that your system has a symmetry. Okay, and word identity for conformal transformation is extremely constraining. Essentially, so let me make the statement now, and you can think about it why it's true. It's actually quite amazing. So if you take the two-point function of two operators, so in a usual relativistic field theory, what is the possible dependence of the two-point function? Can someone tell me?
It only depends on the separate the difference and the modulus of the difference.
Yes. Is that some clear to everyone? So the translational invariance just tells you that it depends on x1 minus x2, and rotational invariance tells you that it depends on the norm of x1 minus x2. But for example, in a conformal field theory, the fact that you have extra symmetries constrains this functional dependence completely. Okay, it's completely fixed. The same is true for even more surprising for the three-point function. So the point I want to say is that the two and the three-point functions, the position dependence is completely fixed by the conformal symmetries. So imagine what a drastic simplification we had. Here we said that you have an arbitrary function, and every physical system could be a completely different function, and you have to solve the problem, solve the system essentially to know what function you get. Here it's actually even worse. Maybe a good exercise for you to see is write down the most general three-point function in a relativistic theory, only imposing Poincaré symmetry. Okay, you'll see that there's a lot of freedom. But in the conformal field theory, it's completely fixed again. Okay. And that's part of the reason why for conformal field theories, we can do more things, because the observables are much more constrained. Okay. Of course, just playing this game of conformal word identity doesn't tell you what the answer is. So the position dependency is fixed, but there's a coefficient that has to be computed. But it's very different to say that you have to compute one coefficient than you have to compute what the function is. It has an infinite number of parameters. The coefficient is only one coefficient. And that will require extra ideas and dynamics that we will discuss later on. So I should probably stop. But so maybe what you can try to do, so in the next time I will derive and explain intuitively why conformal symmetry. Actually, you could do the exercise yourself. Try to think why conformal symmetry, just geometrically, why conformal symmetry fully determines this? Just geometrically, don't try to solve word identities or anything. Just to say you have a collection of symmetries. Just use these ideas that, okay, I can move points using the symmetry to particular points and see why essentially this statement is true. Okay. But and just to make sure that you know that this ends here. If you go to a four-point function, the four-point function is not uniquely determined. the position dependent is not really determined, but then we will use something clever to constrain what that function is. All right. Yes.
I have one question about the scaling dimension and mass dimension, because in one QFT homework, we computed the anomalous dimension of one operator, and it is like the operator had a certain mass dimension, but when we computed the beta function, we saw that that's not the real dimension. Is that related with this dimension, or is it completely different?
No, okay, so for example, since I don't know exactly the exercise you're talking about, yes, no, but in general it's true. For example, I remember I discussed the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. Remember I discussed it at some point. So there it was an energy flow, a very short energy flow from a free field theory, where the dimension coincides with a mass dimension, but then it flows to another CFT, right? And for example, the operator that describes what happened here, by the way, it's horrible. Okay. For example, the operator that describes magnetization at the fixed point, in the UV had the free field value for the scaling dimension. At the fixed point does not have the free field value. It's shifted by a small amount that you compute by determining the anomalous dimension. So it actually decreases.
And will we be able to determine all the, I suppose that the answer is no, but like scaling dimensions of even CFT by like perturbative?
No, you never get anywhere with perturbative things. No, definitely not. I mean, if you have a perturbative fixed point, then you can try to compute it in perturbation theory. But for example, for the Ising 3D Ising model, people did this epsilon expansion. And they went to very high orders in epsilon, then put epsilon to one and do all kinds of horrors. I mean, you may be able to do something like that, but definitely there is no controlled way of computing it. The point about here is that forget where this energy flow came from, and just solve directly at the end of the journey and just study there. Don't care about this UV realization. You just focus on the infrared, whatever, on the abstract conformal field theory, devoid of any possible embedding in some energy flow. Yeah. Yes.
I'm a bit confused here about how you're saying that the spatial conformal transformations are in some way formed from the dilatations and the Lorentz rotation. Like,
very concretely, by this statement. So this transformation, this is, if you're in a relativistic quantum field theory, this would be exactly the same. The only difference is that you would only have this term. Omega mu, remember, is the parameter that parameterizes the Lorentz transformation. But I'm saying that if you do a special conformal transformation so that B is non-zero, it acts as exactly a Lorentz transformation, but it's x-dependent. Likewise, also here, if I do a dilatation, you would get this. But if I do a special conformal transformation, what you get is a local dilatation. It's in this sense I'm saying these words.
Maybe the reason this is confusing to me is because somehow special conformal transformations are lowering operators, while these Lorentz transformations and dilatations, like, they're not really changing our operators, right? They're preserving the origin. So how can something that is a lowering operator be built out of things that preserve the origin? It's not.
I mean, the operator transforms under, I mean, the operator transforms under, so okay. So I think what you're asking is, even though it was killed by K at the origin, why does the parameters of the K transformation appear? Okay, and the point is that when you do the, so we know the transformation at the origin. One way to do it is you know the transformation at the origin, computed at a finite point. So imagine I say O of X is e to the I, P mu x mu of 0 e to the minus I P mu x mu, right? That's how you would do it. But now if I act, I mean, I'm saying that, but P's do not commute with K's, okay? So that's why that even though there was no K quantum number or no dependence on K at the origin, there is dependence on K if you are away from the origin. That's exactly what you see, right? If x is non-zero, if x is zero, there is no B dependence.
Right.
But if x is non-zero, you have B dependence. And it just has to do with the fact that you have to conjugate by P. Yeah.
So something I'm getting from this is, I didn't get that at first, the primary is killed by K only at the origin.
Yes.
Only at the origin.
Yes.
Okay.
For the correlators, do you time?
Time ordering? Yes. I mean, you don't have, people study also at, these are very popular nowadays, out of time ordered correlators, but. Yeah, it's not that you have to, but you can. These are like the ones that you typically study, time ordered. I can conform with theories, but don't we study a radially ordered operator, and you will see why. Radially ordered, so radius. Precisely because let me not say why, because that will take us too far away. But essentially, because the hero of conformal field theories is not a Hamiltonian; it's a dilatation operator. And you can ask, what are the surfaces that the dilatation operator propagates? And these are spheres. So you can think of the dilatation operator as a Hamiltonian, where time moves in the radial direction. But anyway, these are just words for now. We will see this.